The ramp was closed from 196 getting off to get to church, so I'm a little bit thrown off, shall we say, because we're late. We're starting a few minutes late. That clock is that correct now? Okay. All right. This morning, I'm assuming probably other people are going to be bitten by their unawareness of the fact that that ramp is closed and might be coming in late. Lesson 39, this morning, last Sunday we talked about the Catholic Counter-Reformation and how the Catholics responded to the Reformers and some things along those lines. Now today what we want to do is look at, I titled the lesson, Lesson 39, Westward Ho, the Old Religion in the New World. Okay? Now, as we get started here, a couple things by introduction. Now, look, what we're going to say here this morning, you could take whole classes in college just on the religious settlement and colonization of the colonies in America, okay? And how everything came about and how it developed. And so what we're going to do today is just sort of like an overview of some key points, some things that I think are necessary. So yeah, time's not going to allow us to consider everything, and consequently, I've tried to choose the people and events that I think best fit the overall purpose that we have in this class with tracing the recovery of Pauline truth. Now, so what we're going to try to focus on then is upon the religious trends. We want to look kind of like a big picture at the trends that we could see in the settling, in the European colonization, exploration, and settlement of North America, but the New World in general, and then also the subsequent development of American denominationalism. Denominationalism is an interesting thing in and of itself, and it's in some ways a uniquely American experience, and I think I'll try to explain what I mean by that as we go on. Now, obviously, do you find any denominations mentioned specifically in the Bible? Were you guys bit by the ramp being closed? Yeah, so was I. There's no denominations mentioned in the Bible. There's no old joke amongst grace preachers, particularly grace preachers, that the largest denomination in the Bible is the ignorant brethren. Okay? So, that being the aside, we're going to look at some things regarding that. So to get us started, I want to look at, the first point is beyond Europe. Okay? Missionologist David Barnett has estimated that in 1500, something like 95% of the world's Christian population was concentrated in Europe. So 1500, on the eve of the Reformation, 95% of all Christian people in the world are concentrated to Europe. Now you and I, we'd say, we know and understand that not all those people are, quote, Christian or saved the way you and I would understand that term to be used. Catholic reform by the mid-16th century marks an extraordinarily important turning point in the history of Christianity because it inspired a wide range of active, practical steps that began to translate the worldwide potential of the Christian faith into reality. The Catholic Counter-Reformation and the work of the Jesuits, like we discussed last Sunday, is going to really start to press the envelope when it comes to new waves of Christian missions. Now, Mark A. Noll, in his book, Turning Points, divides sort of the history of Christian missions, if you will, into three general categories, okay, of roughly 500 years each. He says that from 100 to 500, he defines it as cross-cultural evangelism, as the teachings of Christianity was successfully translated into the Hellenistic and Roman cultures of the broader Mediterranean world. So he sees that as being a unique time period. Then from about 500 to 1500, or 1000 AD, he saw a series of breakthroughs when missions moved northward into barbarian Europe and began a centuries-long process of restating the Christian message into the cultural idiom of the northern tribes. During this time, the reach of Christianity expanded from Ireland in the west in the 5th century to the Slavic Russians in Kiev in the east. Okay? So that's sort of a second sort of explosion in Christian missions, and understanding much of this is Catholic. This is not things that you and I would necessarily agree with. But then he identifies a third period from about 1000 to 1500, which is marked by efforts to evangelize marked more by efforts to evangelize the baptized within Christendom than by efforts at spreading Christianity into new unchurched cultures. During the Middle Ages, there were few significant missionary efforts beyond Christian Europe. So there's sort of a phase one, Christianity is taken out to the ancient Hellenistic Roman culture. Phase two, it begins to be taken to the northern areas, tribes, go all the way up to Ireland in the west, and northwest, and all the way across to areas of Russia in the east. But then from 1000 to 1500, it sort of condenses back in on itself, and there's probably good reasons for that when you consider the bubonic plague, the Hundred Years' War, other things that are going on during that time period. There's not a lot of, the focus becomes mostly on trying to make sure all the Christians within Christendom, if you will, are in order. And that's when we've already studied these things. That's when the Inquisition is formed and the church is going around trying to hunt down anybody that's gonna, you know, protest or disagree with the teachings of the Catholic Church. Now, currents then, in the 16th century, Catholic reform drastically altered the focus on missionary activity. One of the things that the Catholic Counter-Reformation does is it stresses the issue of missions. This is now going to be after Columbus, sea routes to India and China have already been discovered by Bartholomew Diaz and these guys, Vasco da Gama, have already discovered these routes, and so the Catholics are going to adopt a more outreach, mission focus as a result of this Catholic Counter-Reformation. So, current to the 16th century, Catholic reform drastically altered the focus on missions activity and once again landed Christendom as an aggressive course extending to the whole world. New orders such as the Jesuits, as well as revived old orders, the Augustinians and Dominicans, spearheaded this move within the Catholic Church. Now again, we see three general groups here. The Augustinian monks are going to send missionaries to Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Chile, India, China, the Philippines, Kenya, and Arabia. Okay? So that's the Catholic Augustinians that are going to be doing that. Now I want to point something out. Notice, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Chile, these are all areas of Central and South America. Okay? The Dominicans are going to formulate a strategy of evangelism toward the Native Americans, and they're going to focus their efforts on the New World. So this would be parts of modern-day Mexico, California, Arizona, Florida, parts of what now make up the United States. And then the Jesuits are going to work in China, Japan, China, New France is going to be a big area for them, and also amongst the Huron Indians. So this Catholic mission, if you will, is going to be spearheaded by three different groups that are going to adopt specific strategies and target regions for where they're going to try to spread the reach of the Catholic Church. Okay?
Where is New France and Huron something?
That'd be up in what's now Canada.
What's New France? That's up there. Here.
Yeah, I got some maps here I'm going to show you in a minute, bud.
Were there any non-Catholic?
Not at this time.
So the devil is kind of in the race.
At this point, Early on,
this is almost dominated exclusively by the Catholics.
Okay? Now, the age of the Reformation was a time of social, intellectual, national, economic expansion, as well as religious change. Western Europe entered the 16th century stronger and more aggressive than it had been at any time in its history. England emerged as a European power. In Spain, during the last years of the 15th century, the kingdom was united under Ferdinand and Isabella, and the last strongholds of the Muslim Moors were overcome. The nation took the lead in exploring the New World, one result of the growing strength among these great nations, and also lesser ones such as Portugal and Holland, was competition in Europe. Another was competition for empires overseas. Now what happens is, and you know the story, most of you I think would know something about this, the fact that These traditional European rivalries are now going to play themselves out on a world stage, as they're going to literally race for empire in the New World to claim lands, to demonstrate that they can control the lands, and to establish colonies as money-making ventures for the mother or the parent country. Okay? The European nations wanted profit from their American explorations. But only Spain found it, and only for a brief period. Yet the drive for raw materials from the colonies and then a more general pursuit of trade became a permanent feature of European life. The spirit of the Renaissance also stimulated exploration across the Atlantic, for the virgin territory of America held out the promise of new knowledge, personal glory, and a liberation from stifling European traditions. Expansion to America, in other words, shared fully in the energies that drove Europe as a whole during the early modern period. So there's a lot of forces here that are driving this. Also from the start, however, European believers took a religious interest in America. As the career of Christopher Columbus illustrates, there was an interest with both fidelity and tragedy that would characterize the whole history of Christianity in North America. So really it's the Jesuits that are gonna really expand this idea of missions. Okay, the Jesuits and the Roman Catholics are going to be the leaders in this. And other nations that come along later are also going to, you know, become involved in this. But a lot of this is not necessarily, the religious aspect of this in some ways is, for a lot of the people involved, an afterthought. Okay? Now it is true that the Spanish conquistadors, when they came across, did bring with them Catholic bishops, Catholic monks, and friars and so forth, and started immediately to try to, quote, Christianize the native populations of the areas that they went to, okay? But this idea of a mindset beyond just Europe is a greater product of the emerging modern world as much as it is an issue between religious competition and struggle. Now, before we go on to the next point, does anybody have any questions about that? Okay, Catholics in the new, Catholic enclaves in the New World. Columbus's very first entry in the diary that recorded his journey to America in 1492 expressed the hope that he could make contact with the native peoples in order to find out the manner in which may be undertaken their conversion to our holy faith. Now, when Columbus said that, what faith is he talking about? Catholicism. Okay? His second journey, in 1493, Columbus took with him Catholic friars, whom he hoped could convert the Indians that he had seen on their first voyage. To the Spanish monarchs, Columbus insisted that profits from his voyages be used to restore Christian control over Jerusalem. So, Columbus sort of had a little bit of a religious motivation from the beginning, okay? One of the things that he gets the King and Queen of Spain to agree to is that a portion of the profits from his journeys would be used to send over there to the Middle East to try to restore Christian domination over the city of Jerusalem. So Columbus views himself as sort of this, almost as a religious figure that is after the well-being, the religious well-being and spiritual welfare of the people of the islands that he's landing in. And by the way, Columbus died never realizing that he was not in India. He always thought he was in India, and he never realized that, oh geez, really, we're not in India. Okay? But he viewed himself as sort of having a spiritual mission here. A year after Columbus's first voyage, Pope Alexander VI issued a papal bull aimed at settling the competing territorial aspirations of Spain and Portugal. Now, Portugal is another leader here in the Age of Exploration. Prince Henry the Navigator founds a school of navigation, and it's his school of navigation and his pupils that eventually circumvent the southern coast of Africa. And then Vasco da Gama is the first guy to make it all the way underneath Africa, across to India, and back. Okay? So the Portuguese are also factoring heavily into this, and the Portuguese are also what religion? Catholic. So there's this dispute here. The Pope's reasons for doing so were to seek out and discover certain islands and mainlands remote and unknown and not hitherto discovered by others so that explorers, notice, might bring to might bring to the worship of our Redeemer and the profession of the Catholic faith their residents and inhabitants. So,
for the Catholic Church the entire time, as part of this, as these Catholic countries go out and explore, they have it as a goal from the beginning to Catholicize or Christianize, so-called, these native people and bring them into the Catholic Church.
Was that because they were only controlling the colonies that they could actually monitor?
Yeah, what happens,
what ultimately is going to happen down here, that point we're just talking about this, that there's going to be ultimately a line of demarcation here in South America where the Portuguese get Brazil and the Spanish are basically going to get everything else. Okay?
That's why the Portuguese versus the Spanish language.
Yeah, that's why Brazil speaks Portuguese and all the rest of Latin America and South America speak Spanish. Because, and again, it goes back to the stuff that we're talking about here. But all of these, I know maybe you can't see this real well, but here's Cortez coming in here, Coronado, Cazaba, all these guys, Pizarro down here in Peru and Chile. All of these Spanish conquistadors, when they come in and start exploring these areas and claiming them for Spain, they're also bringing with them what?
Catholic
friars, monks, and so on, that are going to start the process of Christianizing these lands. And so the Pope has issued the bull to stop any fighting that's going to go on here so that the process of the gospel, if you will, from the Pope's point of view, can go forward in the new world. And so that's why the majority of South America, Central America, and basically everything from Mexico south, including the Caribbean islands, is all heavily to this day Roman Catholic. Because the Europeans that came and subdued these areas and settled in them were all Roman Catholic. Okay? Now, the first well-established Christian institution in the New World for the Catholics came, let me read that again. The first well-established Christian institution in the New World came from the Catholics. Before the English settled permanently in Jamestown in 1607, thousands of Indians had become at least nominal believers under Catholic missionaries in the New Mexico territories. And the first printed hymn book in America was not the Puritans' Bay Psalm book of 1640, but the ordinary of the Mass in Mexico City in 1556. So you can see... So you can see that by the time Roanoke and Jamestown are founded here, the Spanish have already had a Catholic mission to this whole region here for about 60 years.
Okay.
What about St. Augustine? When was that settled? Does that precede
St. Augustine
in Florida?
Yeah, the Spanish knew about that, and they were already working Florida. I got another map here I'll show you in a second. So, the Roman Catholics, in significant numbers, came relatively late to what would be the United States. Okay? What would ultimately be the United States. They were present at the first permanent settlers of Canada, and also provided a foundational contribution to the later Canadian civilization. Like their counterparts in New Spain, the traders, trappers, and settlers of New France were accompanied by Catholic priests, nuns, and brothers. Missionary work among the Native Americans in Canada had been ongoing for two generations before the most famous French explorations of the United States took place. Okay? So if you think about the United States, north of what would become the United States is going to become heavily Catholic under the headship of France, and then the southern half of the United States and everything south is going to be heavily influenced by the Catholic Spanish. Okay? Now, in 1630, the French explorer Jacques Cartier stated the following after contact with the Native Americans: "Living without God and without religion like brute beasts, I thereupon concluded my private judgment that I should be committing a great sin if I did not make it my business to devise some means of bringing to them the knowledge of God. So, again, do these Catholics have sort of a, what they believe to be a moral compulsion to do this? Okay? How many have heard of Joliet? When Louis Joliet explored the upper Mississippi River Valley in 1673, a Jesuit father named Jacques Marquette, who is the Marquette University in Milwaukee, is Wisconsin is named after him, was his companion. Joliet was seeking trade and establishment of French claims in the region, and Marquette was seeking souls. He had long heard of the Illinois Indians, rumored to be a vast multitude, inhabited the mainlands of the continent. Now, so here we go.
This, all this area up in here, this is New France. Quebec is right here, and this area and all in here is going to be dominated by the Catholics. Okay? Even if you go to the city of Chicago, even if you go to areas along this half of the Mississippi, or Lake Michigan, the western side of Lake Michigan, they're still heavily Catholic areas. Up in there, okay? And then the English colonies, Protestantism is going to be down in this region right in here. But New France is going to be dominated by the Catholics. Whoops, did I get that? Yeah.
Franciscan missionaries made a significant contribution to the colonization of New France. But most of the Christian missionary work was carried on by the Jesuits. Jesuits whose missionary service in the Far East had been marked by an effort to adopt the faith to Asian cultures showed some of the same cultural sensitivity in North America. French colonial officials, considerably more enlightened than their Spanish counterparts, then encouraged mission work, but also tried to make active religious life a part of the developing French colonies. While the Roman Catholic Church in France was caught up in the Enlightenment and in the French Revolution, Catholicism in Quebec remained spiritually and intellectually conservative. It continued to take its orders from the Pope. It aspired to a nearly medieval control over the lives of French Canadians, and it promoted a piety based on traditional rather than modern Roman Catholic practices. So in other words, the majority of New France is staunchly Catholic at the time. Alright? In contrast to Quebec, where steady support for the church and state led eventually to a deeply rooted Catholic structure, the beginnings of Catholic settlement in what would become the United States were more haphazard. George Calvert and his son Cecil and the first and second Lords Baltimore were the founders of Maryland. The only one of the original 13 colonies with a significant Roman Catholic population. So, when you get to what would eventually become the United States, the state of Maryland was really the only real Catholic enclave in what would ultimately become the United States, and that's going to be established by the Baltimores. Soon after the arrival of the first settlers in 1634, Catholic missionaries began work among the Native Americans in the colony. While most of the other settlers turned to the raising of tobacco, the mainstay of the missionary enterprise was the Jesuit Andrew White. White was a determined proponent of Thomas Aquinas' theology and had labored as both a priest in England and a teacher in France before coming to the aid of the Colverts. So, when we think about Catholic enclaves in the New World, you think North, Canada, and you think South, New Spain, California, New Mexico, Arizona, Mexico, Central America, South America are all going to go to the Spanish, and the Spanish are going to be setting up Catholic settlements in those areas. Okay? Any questions about that before we move on to the Protestants? It's a family name.
Mm-hmm. You were saying back in the couple points ago about the Roman Catholic Church in France, product of Enlightenment and French Revolution, and how Catholicism was supposed to be spiritually and intellectually conservative. So what was the modern Catholic practices that they were that were going on in France?
Well, if you know, France was overrun with the Enlightenment. We're going to talk about that next week. And ultimately the French Revolution, where a bunch of French people were flat out denying basically going against everything the church had to say, not for religious reasons, but for intellectual reasons. And the Catholic Church in France itself is going to really kind of take it on the chin as a result of the French Revolution. Okay? Any other questions about that stuff?
What motivates these countries to the different areas? Is it because France was more interested in the fur trade that they promoted that northern area?
To some degree. To some of it, too, is just...
Is it climate difference? I mean, preference for climate?
The reason, to me, Columbus... It's going to sound highly uncharitable, but Columbus is kind of a nincompoop, to be honest. Okay, Columbus goes to a monastery and finds the calculations of Ptolemy, and guesses on the circumference of the earth and packs for his trip based on this calculation that he got for Ptolemy. If Columbus doesn't find land within 3 days, the crew is going to kill him, and he's going to have to go. They're going to go back without him. They're going to mutiny on him. Okay. And he lands in this island, and he thinks he's in the West Indies. And it's not until a few years later that other explorers discover, wait a minute, this is not India, this is not the West Indies, this is something that, you know, we didn't really even know that to the mindset of most Europeans, didn't even know it was there. Now, to some extent, the reason why the Spanish are in the south, to me, is just the luck, if you want to view it that way, of where they ended up landing. That's where they were, and then so from there, from Hispaniola, the island where Columbus first landed, they spread out to the west, to the north, and to the south, and that's just kind of the way it goes. Now, why the French ended up in Canada, I'm a little less familiar with that specifically. But
from Canada to Wisconsin, the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, so the water range down.
So they have big
waterway in front of the fur trade propagated somewhere.
And so that's where their main thing was, you know, as you already said, was the fur trade.
Now on that map of Canada, you have the new France stops. Is that just because that area up north of it wasn't explored, or?
But mostly.
Because it's like, who could
Well, and eventually, as you know, France and England are going to fight a war over, you know, control of this territory here, the French and Indian War, known to the colonists as such. In Europe, it was known as the Seven Years' War because there was more involved with it than just that. But I mean, all these forces are affecting the settlement of the New World and how the religion is impacting the colonies and ultimately the country as it's being established.
Now, is the border, our northern border with Canada, basically established at that time?
No.
7 years ago? Because I can see where the...
Parts of it.
The river and...
Parts of it are established.
In the east, and then it looks like they just drew a line for the western end. So I don't know.
The western end. I don't recall when they even developed that particular border. Protestantism in the New World. The Great Pilgrim Migration to the New World took place when it appears as if opportunities for reform were closed off in England. By the time the Puritans established Massachusetts, however, there were already other English colonial ventures that had secured a foothold in the New World. Now, I want to point this out to you. This map here, this map says, okay, that there were 20,000 Puritans that make it to New England and Virginia, the majority of which are going to settle in New England, okay? Some of them are going to come down here also into what we call the islands down here in the Caribbean. This map here shows you where these Puritans are coming from in England. Okay? So you can see that the majority of the Puritans that are going to make it to Massachusetts are coming from the eastern coast of England itself, and these are the ones that are going to end up establishing the communities here in Massachusetts. But before they come across,
there's a colony, an English colony that predates them, and that's Jamestown. Okay? Now, England's first permanent settlement was the Virginia colony, established at Jamestown in 1607. Historians have customarily contrasted the secular character of the founding of Virginia with the more overtly religious settlement of the Puritans in to the north in Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay. It is true that the Virginia Company of London was more interested in turning a profit than the Massachusetts Bay Company that later settled in Boston. Okay? It is also true that the dispersed pattern of settlement in Virginia was not conducive to the close spiritual fellowship that was possible in the northern English colonies. As soon as the first settlers arrived in 1607, for example, they were joined by Reverend Robert Hunt. Religious and courageous divine, according to Captain John Smith, in holding the service of communion. As part of Virginia's incorporation, the Church of England was made the colony's established church. Okay? So the official Church of England is established as part of the colonial charter of Jamestown and Virginia as the official church of the colony. So you need to know that, okay? This establishment would eventually lend a very different flavor to the religion in the Chesapeake region than it had in New England. You know, one of the things, if you study, I got
books here that study this stuff. I'm not even going to attempt to draw it, but if you think about the Chesapeake Bay area,
when those settlers went in there, they spread out along the rivers and water inlets. When the pilgrims and those guys came to Massachusetts, they didn't spread out. They all congregated together in the close-knit communities. And so the difference in how they structured the community also led to differences in how the religious life of the colonies played itself out. Okay? That's just something that you need to sort of be aware of. England's next permanent colony bore the stamp of Puritanism much more definitely. The settlers who arrived in 1620 at Plymouth in southeastern Massachusetts were in some senses even more consistent than those who later came to Boston. While other Puritans were still contending in England for the thought of reform of the church and the religious life of the nation, the Plymouth settlers had largely abandoned that effort in order to carve out a separate society for themselves.
So here you see this other map. Plymouth is right here, and so this entire area here is, especially up and down the coast of Massachusetts here in New England, this is going to be, have a totally different religious sort of flavor to it than what was going on down in Virginia. Virginia, the official church is still the Church of England. These guys are all separatists and don't want to have anything to do with the Church of England. Okay?
Now, under Pastor John Robinson, this congregation chose first to go to Holland. Now, I don't know how much of your American history you remember, but the pilgrims go first to Holland. Now, the Dutch allow them, I'm just going to summarize this point, the Dutch allow them to worship how they want. But what the pilgrims end up having, they view the Dutch society as too permissive and too capitalistic and profit-minded, and they feel it's going to corrupt and ruin their children. So because of that, they decide they want to go try it in the New World, and so from there, they eventually are going to make an agreement and head over. And their original intent, okay, let me go to this point. Did I miss a point here? No. These pilgrims secured the sponsorship of English merchants in the Virginia Company, and eventually surmounted an unremitting series of difficulties aboard the Mayflower, September 6, 1620, for the New World. They sailed for Virginia. So their original intent was to go where? To Virginia. So they were blown off course to Cape Cod, where they arrived in early November. They decided to stay, but before leaving the ship, the male passenger signed an agreement. Obviously the what? Mayflower Compact, and this is a portion of it. Having undertaken for the glory of God and for the advancement of the Christian faith, and the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia. Do these presents solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforementioned. So they definitely view themselves as being more sort of communally organized as a group than what was going on in Virginia. And they're going to settle New England along that different sort of mindset and model than what was going on down in Virginia. Now, differences between those who settled in Virginia and Massachusetts help explain some of the regional religious differences. Immigrants to Massachusetts, for example, tended to be older than those to Virginia. And Massachusetts settlers often arrived with their families. More important, the Massachusetts colonists were determined localists, offended by Charles I's efforts to control the churches, economies, and militia of their English communities. Immigration offered an opportunity to preserve the values, religious, political, and social, of these local communities. Now, I want to read you a section here out of a book I use. It's page 52 of A History of Christianity in the United States of America by Mark Knoll. It says, circumstances in the New World made it possible for the values of the two societies imported to flourish in their respective colonies. New England's climate and soil were similar to what the colonists had known in England, and thus settlers could rapidly recreate English agricultural patterns. New England offered no obvious product for profitable export, and European diseases had significantly reduced the Indian population in the region. The result was an environment nourishing the communal self-sufficiency that the New Englanders had brought with them from the old country. It was an environment that made congregationalism in the Puritan pattern possible. On the other hand, the combination of values and settlement patterns in Virginia encouraged independent estates and a culture of manhood that fostered extravagant gambling, and it also nurtured black slavery, a system in which all whites stood in authority over a population of subservient workers. So the differences, the cultural differences are related, and religious differences are related to not only the mindset, but how the colonies are settled. Okay? And by the way, do those differences still exist? I mean, eventually these vast differences of opinion are going to lead to the Civil War if you extrapolate out far enough, especially the slavery issue and some other things. The first Baptist congregation in America was formed in 1639 with the help of Roger Williams in Rhode Island. The English and Welsh individuals who made up this body agreed with Williams that the life of the church should not be governed by the state. Although Rhode Island continued to be a center for colonial Baptists, Williams himself remained a Baptist, interestingly, for only a few months. I really don't know why. Particularly because of such opposition, and partially because of more general conditions in the colonies, Baptist growth was slow. General Baptists from England did establish a few congregations in the South, and Rhode Island remained a haven for General Baptists in New England. But until the Great Awakening in the 1740s, Baptists achieved only a slight presence in the New World. So the Baptists were not represented in very high amounts early on in the settlement of the country. Yeah.
Were they basically the same in their theology then as they are today? Or?
I'm telling you, the Baptists to me are one of the most... There are so many subdivisions and divisions of the Baptist denomination that, number one, you can't keep them all straight, and number two, it's almost impossible to figure out clearly why they're all not just Baptists. Because in some cases, the differences are so minute that it's like, come on. But I can't answer that specifically. I just know that they were generally, even if you take all these Baptists, all the different Baptist groups now, they all still say they're all what? They're all Baptists. So the main point you need to know is where Baptists first had an influence,
and the fact that they were not that influential early on until the First Great Awakening. That's the two main things you need to know about the Baptists. Outside of New England, the Church of England was the major religious presence in the early British colonies. It was an established church in Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Maryland after 1691, and part of New York City after 1693. Yet the American environment, the establishment, was often very thin. English experience provided no precedent for the vast New World parishes. Think about the compactness of England, and now think about America. And so they're trying to take this Church of England and bring it to America and say, okay, here, do it the same way you did it there. And when you have a parish that's 550 square miles, it's not easy to do this. So there's going to have to be some rethinking of some things on the part of these people. Yeah. It offered precious few resources for dealing with rough, individualistic, honor-driven, slaveholding society in the southern colonies. Now, the Church of England's great importance in America, in early America, derived not primarily from its intrinsic strength or weakness, but from the fact that it was still England's established church. So long as the colonies remained English, the Church of England played a major role in religious life. Now, I want to say something about this. The first generations of settlers, did they still view themselves as English? But as time went on, they had less and less and less of an attachment to England. Right? And they started to forge their own identity. Okay? Now, when the time of the revolution comes along, there's going to be real pressure for people to leave the Church of England. And if you stayed in the Church of England, you were almost viewed as, you know, a Tory, as being loyal to the crown. And so a lot of people who may have been reared in the Church of England are going to leave as a result of the American Revolution. But up to that point, it was the most populous church because they all still viewed themselves as English, and it was the Church of England, and it was established in a lot of those southern colonies and so forth. Quakers, or Friends, as they called themselves, under their leader George Fox, appeared in New England within a generation of the founding of Massachusetts. Anne Austin and Mary Fisher came to Boston with their message of the inner light of Christ and their criticism of formal external religion. The Puritan authorities immediately sent these Quaker witnesses packing, and in the period from 1659 to 1661, four Quakers were hanged in Massachusetts for sedition, blasphemy, and persistent disturbance of the peace. So, look, I want to say something here. These Puritans, were they religiously tolerant? Uh-uh. If you weren't Puritan, if you weren't in their group and you taught anything, here you have in the New World the religious authorities of one colony hanging other members of another denomination or another branch of Christianity because they're not going along or they're teaching doctrine that they don't approve of. Okay? You need to be this whole lot, you know. Let me be careful how I say this. I believe that the Puritans, when they came here, they wanted to establish their own religion as the religion. Okay? So all this stuff about religious freedom, yeah, in a sense it's true, but in a sense it's not true. They were not religiously tolerant of anybody that disagreed with them, any more than certain Catholics were or certain other groups were. Yeah.
I think the only part of colonial America that actually was for religious tolerance was Pennsylvania.
And we're going to get to that in a second, yeah.
That probably also comes from the fact that they were driven out of Europe because of intolerance. So they thought, oh, hey, this is hard right now.
Well, that's what they were all about, establishing their own religious state. Rhode Island offered much more freedom for beliefs than the much more freedom for beliefs than the Puritans judged to be deviant. So it soon became a site of considerable Quaker settlement. The colonial settlement that put the Quakers permanently on the American map was Pennsylvania. And the man who had accomplished this deed was William Penn. In 1681, Penn acquired a huge tract of land from King Charles II in settlement over a debt owed to his father. Pennsylvania thereafter became the most secure home for religious toleration in the world at the time, actually. And with immigration to America from Scotland and the north of Ireland, the county soon became home to increasing numbers of Presbyterians. And you get the point here, okay? The Presbyterians are coming. I'm just going to go through this, some of these things a little bit quicker now for the sake of time. The New World also made room for, very early on, for religious groups from other places in Europe. The Dutch, who controlled New York until 1664, brought their hereditary Calvinistic or Reformed faith to that colony. And only after the colony was taken over by the British did vigorous Dutch churches emerge in New York and New Jersey. And so the Christianity brought to America between 1600 and 1900 by hundreds of thousands of Europeans was largely Protestant. Okay? Now I want you to think about this point here. It was built upon the Geneva Bible. The Bible that people brought to Jamestown was a Geneva Bible. The Bible that was on the Mayflower was a Geneva Bible. And these are all revisions, as we already have studied, of a Tyndale New Testament. Right? So, it is built upon the Geneva Bible, which the Pilgrim Fathers brought with them in 1620, and on the King James Bible, which was the first English Bible printed in the United States. Since the King James Bible was also a revision of the Tyndale, as was the Geneva Bible, America was off to a flying start. She became the first nation to be organized and established with a Bible translation by anti-Catholic Christians whom Catholics had burned at the stake. That, to me, is a fascinating point. Okay? There are all sorts of theories about why America was what it has been, what it has been, and all sorts of things. One of the things that is never discussed is the nature of what religious Christianity in America was based on. It is the only country in the history of the world to be founded on a Bible that the Catholics killed people for producing. And it helps explain in some way why it was not until 1960 that a Roman Catholic was even elected president of the country. You know that there was a major uproar in this country in 1960 when JFK ran for president because he was Catholic. And because...
He even made a statement that he wasn't going to be ruled by the Pope.
Because people were afraid that he was going to take America and put him under the authority of the Pope. And so there was a big controversy. Okay? So, for all of Ruckman's problems, sometimes he points out something that is extremely insightful about the history of the country. And it's something that I think has been overlooked. And I'm going to just make a suggestion to you, just real quick. And my suggestion is this. It's interesting when you look at what happened to the body of Christ since 1960. The proliferation of modern translations into common acceptance in this country, it happened in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. And the translation that has replaced the King James Bible as the standard English Bible is fundamentally a Latin Vulgate Bible translated into English. So, there are things here that are worth considering that aren't often talked about when it comes to the religious history of the country and why things sort of went the way they did. And one of those sort of underlying things that's not discussed a lot is the actual Bible that was being used by the people that were founding the country. So, take that for what it's worth. Yeah?
I'm not real clear on what was taught in the Catholic Church. Was it all in Latin? Did the people understand what was being said at the church? Or how did it really influence their lives if it wasn't in their own language?
It influenced their lives to the extent that the clergy would read it and teach them what was in it.
So they would tell them in their own language what it's
called. They wouldn't even teach them in their own language. All the Mass was done in Latin.
So that's what I'm having a hard time understanding how they got anything out of it.
Well, they didn't. But that was by design. The church wanted to keep them ignorant.
Yeah.
because they knew that as soon as
they were Catholic in name, but not in practice. I mean, I don't understand what influence the church really had except for a ritual that they went to.
Well, that's
didn't understand.
That's basically it.
Oh, okay.
But in the Middle Ages, they literally controlled every facet of their lives.
Yeah. And then that was one means of control, because the people couldn't think for themselves. They had to go to the...
They,
I'm just curious if it had any real power over them because of that.
Well, they had power. We talked about two issues. We talked about the power of interdiction and the power of excommunication. And what the Catholic Church could do is they could excommunicate you and deny you the sacraments. And according to Catholic theology, if you're denied the sacraments, you're damned to hell for eternity.
Okay?
But the other
one is fear.
It's fear, intimidation, all that sort of thing. And they could put a land under interdiction, which meant that if, let's say Dave here is the king of some fiefdom or something like that, and I'm mad at him and I'm the Pope, I could either excommunicate him, or I could put his land under interdiction. And if I put his land under interdiction, what that meant is that no one in his fiefdom would be administered the sacraments. So the idea is that everybody in his fiefdom is going to rise up in anger and hostility with Dave because he's not following what the Pope wants him to do, and then Dave will change his mind and I get what I want.
So they're more like the mafia controlling the fear and intimidation and a threat.
Yeah.
And it wasn't any personal motivation to praise God or do things right.
I would say that that'd be a fair way of stating the situation. Yeah.
Were all the churches back in Europe, whether they were Protestant or Catholic, expecting some kind of taxation or some kind of giving to go back to them?
The denominations?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at that.
Catholicism expecting a return on
them? I'm sure the Catholics were, to some degree, yeah. Okay. Now, we're probably not going to have enough time to finish this, but American denominational tradition. According to Sidney Anstrom, author of Religious History of the American People, there are five types of religious accommodation as the old religion was transferred to the new world. Okay?
The first one are nominal members of European state churches. So these would be members of the official state churches of the countries of Europe. Okay? Who through perhaps joining lodges and other fraternal orders in the New World used immigration as an occasion to abandon formal religion. So here's a group of people that come to the New World and they say what? Nope, I'm not going to have really anything to do with that anymore. The second were sectarians, illustrated by various migrations of Mennonites who found New World opportunities denied in the Old to pursue long-held visions of ecclesiastical purity. So this is going to be where some of your Baptist, your early Baptist groups are going to be coming into play, the Anabaptists and so forth. Third, were seventh sectarians who pursue pietistic or perfectionist or reformist goals with the European state church. But when they came to America, joined the denominations of evangelical Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, or Congregationalists. Fourth were members of European state churches who, upon arrival to America, founded parallel denominations to those which they had been pleased at home, or were members of at home, like the American Episcopal Church or the German or Dutch Reformed churches. And fifth were those who created new ecclesiastical bodies in the New World, like the Christian Reformed Church and several Lutheran denominations, but who did so in order simply to replicate churches they had left in the old world.
So there are five sort of distinct ways in which people came to the new world and religious attitudes that they had and the resulting ways in which the different Protestant churches became organized in the colonies. I guess we're just going to have time to look at this map, and I guess we're going to have to finish the rest of this stuff either next week, or maybe we'll just have to read it on your own out of the notes. But if you look at this,
the old religion adjusted to the new world. Some things changed while others remained the same as the Christian faith took root in the new world. Continuities and discontinuities differed substantially on when the migrations took place, where they ended up, and what material conditions shaped them. Varied as the different movements of old religions in North America were,
They shared in common the need to adjust to a substantially new environment for religious practice. Now, I want you to look at this map here. Okay? So up here, the pink is congregational, and all of these here, congregational organization, all of these up here are obviously the issue, the churches that are established by the Puritans. Okay? These areas here, this sort of grayish color or brownish color, these are all Anglicans. So these are all Church of England. So you can see here in the south here, most of this part of the country, that the Church of England was the official religion because of how the colony was formed. Lutheran is this green color, so you can see where the Lutherans are going to come and establish. And then Presbyterian is this orangish color. And then you see Jewish, Roman Catholic, and Baptists are going to be scattered out all through here. So depending on when they came, where they came to, what the conditions were when they got there, all these factors are going to shape how these people accommodate the old religion to the new world. Is everybody following what I'm saying here? Is that clock right? Is it 10 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, somebody mark for me on page 7, where it says the history of Christianity in North America, that's where we need to pick it up next Sunday. If we can, I'm going to try to start like 5 minutes early next week so I can finish this and then... Any questions, though, before we go? Yeah, I'll be here by myself. Yeah.
When they came over here, and you said earlier that they brought diseases,
Indians, the Native Americans lacked immunity to European diseases. So when the pilgrims and other groups landed, it was very common for massive amount for Indian populations to be decimated by European diseases such as smallpox. I actually have books that record journals from these Calvinist founders of New England, okay, where they record in their journals that it's the will of God that this land be given to them because the Indians are dying in such massive numbers. Yeah.
There's an ossuary in Massachusetts where the Pilgrims very much died in the winter. And when they asked the graves, so that the Indians didn't realize, that their ranks were being killed by something.
Yeah, they were dying for other reasons than smallpox. But they were dying. They land in November in Cape Cod. So how long before winter sets in fury? Not long. So they did not choose the best time to arrive. But of course they thought they were going to arrive down in Jamestown where stuff was, more relatively established. And so they end up in the middle of nowhere where there's nothing.
Well, didn't they have a partial settlement and even some of them stay on and board ship for the winter, didn't they?
They sent the ship home, and some of them decided to go back.
Yeah, it was bad.
It was not good. And a lot of them died just coming across.
Yeah.
They got sick on the voyage. Yeah, and we got...
Did they think they were more or less in Northern Virginia? Did they actually have any idea how close they really were to the...
I think they had some idea that they were pretty far away from where they originally set out to be. I mean, the navigators knew that they were blown off course. We gotta quit though. I will see you guys next Sunday.
You did that all year last week. I've got it on a wave file. The whole thing.